Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. $300 billion to help rescue some 400,000 homeowners. According to my abacus here, that's $750,000 per homeowner. Think that'll be enough?
I don't expect there are going to be nearly that many people who qualify for all of the terms of this and who are going to find it attractive.
Maybe some lipstick would do the trick? Something in a shade of red ink? Speaking of which, if you're someone who would rather go into debt for a brand name product than buy the same exact thing without a logo, it's time to expel the marketing demons from your psyche.
What are the things that I can satisfy in some other way? You know, the craving for individuality or to be part of something. Maybe what you buy isn't the best way to satisfy those particular desires.
That and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The federal government stretched yet another safety net under the homeowning public this week to a list that already includes Hope Now and Project Lifeline. We can now add the decidedly less aspirational sounding Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008. How many holes do you think this net will have? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com.
As you have no doubt heard, this week the president signed a long-clamored-for housing bill. Its main function is to funnel thousands of at-risk borrowers into low-cost, fixed-rate home loans. It also allows the Treasury Department to act as an official backstop to mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The law comes on the heels of word that one out of every 171 homes in this country is either in or headed toward foreclosure. Chris Mayer teaches real estate finance at Columbia. And Chris, give us the basic outline here. What does the rescue package do?
What the bill does is allows the FHA, Federal Housing Administration, to refinance somebody whose loan is in trouble with a new 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. But there are a lot of conditions with this. It has to be their primary residence. People have to show that there was no fraud in the context of getting their original mortgage. And their new payments have to be no more than 31% of their income. And finally, probably the catch that's going to make this hardest to do is that your existing lender has to approve this.
So this is voluntary on the part of lenders.
Yes, it is voluntary on the part of lenders. And you might imagine that lenders who think you're already going to pay off your mortgage are not going to be very excited about this because they're going to have to reduce the mortgage amount, which for many lenders might involve writing off 20, 30, 40% of their mortgage amount.
Well, if the lender does agree to let you refinance into an FHA loan, what kind of terms are involved in that loan?
Well, this would be standard FHA terms. I think their mortgage rates are around sort of 7%. So these are not the cheapest mortgages in the world. But if you have a 10% adjustable rate subprime mortgage and you can make the payments on it, this might be much more attractive.
All right. Well, let's bring in a couple of listener questions here about the housing bill. And Chris, another Chris is on the line with us from Ames, Iowa. And Chris, why don't you tell us what your situation is?
My wife and I bought a little two-bedroom fixer-upper last year. This is our first house, 15-year fixed-rate mortgage. It's my understanding in the new housing bill, there are incentives for new first-time home buyers. I was wondering if the government was looking at helping out homebuyers that recently bought.
What kind of loan do you have now? You said you have a 15-year loan. Do you have a good interest rate?
6.1, 6.2.
Chris Mayer, what do you think about that? It doesn't sound like he would benefit from this because his interest rate is going to go up if he refinances through FHA, right?
He's certainly not going to find it very attractive to take out the FHA mortgage, but there is another provision in the bill which provides a tax break for first-time homebuyers, which allows a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 or 10% of the home value, whichever is less. So if you bought a home more than $75,000, you would get the $7,500 tax credit. The tax credit isn't like a normal tax credit that you get money from the government and you get to keep it. This is a tax credit that you would have to pay back over a 15-year period, and you're really getting a interest-free loan of $7,500 that you have to pay in equal installments over the next 15 years.
And how far back does it go? I mean, I got my mortgage in, 2004. If I was in trouble on it, could I get help?
Yes.
Okay. We also heard from Emily, who wrote to us from Asheville, North Carolina, and she was a first-time home buyer as of May of this year. But she's thinking that this is, as you said, an interest-free loan that you have to pay back through taxes or when you sell your house. So what's the point of it?
The idea of this is to help people with down payments. One of the other problems that has happened today is while it used to be pretty easy to get no money down or even some money at closing, today lenders are really requiring significant down payments, at least 10%, often 20%. And borrowers are facing very high fees if they put less than that amount down. So the idea of this is to help people with the down payment and avoid some of the onerous fees associated with the low down payment loans, if you can even get one.
What are kind of your thoughts about this housing bill? Is this going to do anything to fix what is an increasingly bad housing market?
Well, I think this is going to do a little bit, and I think the reporting of this in the press suggests that the federal government jumping in may also provide people some additional confidence. But I think in terms of the raw economics of this bill, most of this is likely to affect relatively few people, and we're talking about sort of modest kinds of help. I think the most important part of the bill is the portion that looks to stabilize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and that's the portion of this bill that we're going to be living with a long time after the temporary provisions to help refinance people with subprime loans. I do think that there are real risks with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. If you look at mortgages, for example, even for conforming borrowers who are borrowing normal amounts of money, they're writing mortgages where the payments are effectively 25% more expensive than they would be under normal times.
And why is that happening?
Well, they're trying to make up for many of the losses that they've had on their past loans, and they also are facing almost no competition. The way we're really going to get out of the housing crunch is for new buyers to come into the market, and offering them an interest-free loan of $7,500 doesn't nearly counteract the fact that they're going to pay 1.25% to 1.5% more for a mortgage than they would have a year and a half ago. This sort of has this feel of focusing on relatively small issues and trying to keep Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac afloat without taking the big steps that are going to be required to really shore up the decline in housing prices.
Chris Mayer is the Milstein Professor of Real Estate at Columbia Business School. Thanks so much for coming in and helping us go through the housing bill.
Thanks a lot, Tess. Good talking to you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, in a minute, we're going to talk about the federal deficit. But first, I want to get your quick reaction to this housing bill. And specifically, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you and I had talked about the possibility of the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie. But honestly, looking at this housing bill, I don't see that coming down the pike.
Well, there's a part of this housing bill test that I think is, you know, see no evil, hear no evil.
Yeah.
Management didn't lose their job. don't you think management should have been fired, at least the CEOs? And a lot of the people that I've talked with, there is a little bit of head scratching going on. Well, when are they really going to deal with this? Because you can't continue the way we're going. Nationalization or some form of nationalization seems to be the only logical conclusion. But I guess what Paulson and others in Congress are saying is, let's just get through this period of time and then we'll open up for debate.
Interesting. But for now, the housing package just basically says they're going to stay how they are, but the government will actually guarantee their solvency.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of solvency, this nation is not terribly solvent. Well, I suppose it's solvent, but what do you think about this huge, massive federal budget deficit? We're looking at a record $482 billion. You concerned?
Yes and no. The reason why I'm not that concerned is that the deficit, it isn't really all that big compared to some other periods. Let's take the measure that really matters, the deficit as a share of the economy. At $480, $490 billion, that's equal to about 3.3% of gross domestic product. And that's well below the 6% figure we saw in the early 1980s.
So the absolute figure is a record, but as a share of the economy, it's not.
It's not.
All right, but what about the yes part where it does matter?
This is the part where I just get upset. Look, I really believe that fiscal discipline is important. And what this $490 billion or $480 billion figure tells us, there's no fiscal discipline. And by the way, that projection continues this practice of not including some critical costs, you know, like military action overseas. So the real figure is going to be higher. Here's a straight story. The government needs to publish good numbers. We may not like the results of straightforward accounting. We may recoil. But there's no way out of the budget mess without it.
All right. Tell me why we should bother caring about these federal budget deficit figures. What effect does that actually have on you and me?
Well, I'll tell you one big impact. It is a lot of the commentary that I've been reading and what I've been hearing on the radio, which is saying, well, we got this huge budget deficit. We can't have universal health insurance. We can't have affordable housing. I mean, forget it. We can't afford it. Well, that's wrong. We can afford it. But we need to look at, well, what are we actually spending our money on? Where is it going? And if we're going to have universal health insurance, the response isn't we can't afford it. It is how are we going to pay for it? And that seems to have been dropped in all this discussion. It's perfectly legitimate to say, how are we going to pay for it? So let's have an honest discussion about it. But we can't have that discussion without good numbers and then recognizing that fiscal discipline matters.
Well, certainly there doesn't seem to be any talk of how we're going to pay for it when you hear about a second stimulus package.
And I think we're going to see a second stimulus package.
But a second stimulus package is just going to make the deficit even bigger.
It's going to make the deficit even bigger. That is by definition. But there are ways to design it that it can be effective. For example, state and local governments, they typically have to operate without a deficit. And there are things the federal government can do to offset that so we don't have the massive layoffs that are going to be going on in a lot of states and localities.
The Straight Story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Unless you're lucky enough to get a golden parachute, like all those CEOs who ran their banks into the ground, retirement is not an easy prospect. But if you own your own home, there are options.
It's just a good way for seniors who have some equity in their home, value in the home, to tap into some additional resources to live more comfortably.
It's the reverse mortgage, next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Megland. Earlier in the show, we heard some of the details of the housing bill, but here's one provision we did not get to. The law makes it easier and financially safer for seniors to get reverse mortgages. It puts limits on the fees banks can charge for them. Lenders also cannot require borrowers to buy insurance products like annuities in order to qualify for the loan. Now, for those of you who aren't sure what a reverse mortgage is, Lenora Chu has a primer.
Tom Robinson has a good job as a project engineer in Long Beach. But when his elderly mother started needing help around the house, he knew he couldn't carry the financial burden alone.
She's on a limited income, obviously, being 82. She didn't have much from what my dad had left her, and her house was going to start needing some repairs.
Robinson had seen ads for reverse mortgages on television, and his mother had been getting flyers in her mailbox. In December, they signed on the dotted line. The loan tapped into the equity she'd accumulated to pay off her mortgage and get rid of her monthly payments. And it left her with a $20,000 line of credit to draw down for a paint job, plumbing repairs, and the occasional splurge. When his mother passes on, there will be less equity to leave to her children, but Robinson says he's not bothered.
Not really knowing how long she was going to be here with us, we felt that, you know, she might as well enjoy life while she can.
That's ideally how a reverse mortgage is supposed to work, says Meg Burns of the FHA. The FHA insures 9 out of 10 reverse mortgages in the United States. All are offered through traditional lenders.
It's just a good way for seniors who have some equity in their home, value in the home, to tap into some additional resources to live more comfortably.
Demand for reverse mortgages is expected to rise, but many consumer advocates continue to see reverse mortgages as a last resort for house-rich, cash-poor seniors.
It's one of the options. It's just an expensive option.
That's personal finance columnist Kathy Kristoff. She points out that mortgage insurance and origination fees will put you out 4% of the value of the property. Then there's a service charge that averages out to $30 a month over the life of the loan.
And these fees can add up to tens of thousands of dollars, even on a relatively small reverse mortgage.
Kristoff suggests considering other options first, such as downsizing to a more affordable home to free up some cash. Some local governments also sponsor programs that get seniors into similar loans with lower fees. Or you could sell the home to your adult children and rent it back from them. There are also a few scams to watch out for, says Burns of the FHA. Be wary of brokers who sell you a reverse mortgage and encourage you to use that money to buy another one of their financial products.
And that is because the interest rate that you will pay on that loan will likely be higher than any interest that you would accrue through the investment vehicle or certainly the savings account.
And don't let anyone convince you to draw down the entire loan balance at once. You'll be accruing interest on money you don't necessarily need. And one more thing, says financial advisor Michael Lane, because upfront fees are hefty, take out a reverse mortgage only if you plan to stay in the home for a few years.
As long as the client will be in the house for a sufficiently long period, the expenses amortize over time.
In other words,
if you plan on dying soon, let's not go this way.
But, Lane says, happily, most of his clients plan on sticking around for a long, long time. In Los Angeles, I'm Lenora Chu for Marketplace Money.
Funky, funky. The economic climate has been more than a little funky. This week we learned the unemployment rate has reached a four-year high of 5.7%. But even in places where local governments are declaring bankruptcy, public utilities are supplying more than water and power. They're also providing jobs. Amanda Becker has that story.
Okay, so there's a little place on number two for you to answer. Does it light up? What do you say?
No.
There's a little blank there for you. No.
The school day is ended, but students in this classroom are still hard at work. They're learning how to generate electricity from potatoes. Zinc and copper electrodes are stuck into the spuds, wires are clipped on, and presto, the needle on a voltage meter jumps.
Are you guys in the back with me?
Yeah.
Number three?
This is the first graduating class at the Los Angeles Infrastructure Academy, a voluntary after-school program where students learn about public utilities. They take science courses, go on field trips to power plants, and meet with industry mentors. It's the brainchild of CEO Marcus Castain.
If you look at a young person who's graduating from high school, particularly a poor kid coming out of one of our urban schools in Los Angeles, what are their options? And their realistic options are that they go into fast food, they go into retail, they become a parking valet, or they join the military.
About a year ago, Castain was developing education programs for the city of Los Angeles, trying to figure out how to keep teenagers in school. Then he met Pamela Porter at the Department of Water and Power, and she gave him some enlightening statistics.
Depending on how you count it, it can be anywhere from 35% to over 50% of our employees are eligible for retirement in the next 5 to 7 years.
Pamela was concerned about how does she address her workforce challenge with all of these retiring baby boomers. So one of us was going to bring a supply of all these kids, and the other one was bringing a demand.
So the L.A. Department of Water and Power decided to fund Castaings Academy.
We decided that we had a very strong combined package of interest.
And they're not alone. Utility companies from New Jersey to Georgia are developing similar programs that recruit and train skilled workers. Mary Miller at Edison Electric Institute says these partnerships fill the gap left when many school districts stopped offering vocational classes.
We have seen a real devaluing of skilled trades professions in our society. If you talk to educators, you talk to parents, you talk to guidance counselors, there is an intense focus on traditional four-year college degrees.
But Miller says only about a quarter of students who begin kindergarten end up graduating from college. So utility companies hope to turn high schoolers onto skilled crafts jobs in their industry. Patrick Gillette is a student at the Infrastructure Academy.
It's one of those jobs that people, you don't even think like somebody really does the job, like the person who gets a dead person dressed before the funeral. You know, it's just like, nobody even knows about that job. How do you even get that job?
Once students discover the public utilities, Mary Miller says they'll also find lucrative careers.
A journeyman line worker, typically 5+ years of experience before you get to be a journeyman line worker. We're seeing average wages close to $70,000 a year, and that is without overtime.
If they decide to go to college, that paycheck won't go to tuition bills. Pamela Porter says most utilities will reimburse workers for their education expenses. That's good news for student Alex Bodden.
My new plan is to work for utilities and do night courses 2-3 times a week and gradually get my degrees until I get to a PhD.
And those degrees could lead students like Alex to high-powered careers as they rise through the ranks of the utility industry. In Los Angeles, I'm Amanda Becker for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
And it's time for Getting Personal, where we answer your finance questions. With me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Well, hello again, Tess. It's always good to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, let's go ahead to our first question, which comes to us via an email from Robert, and he is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Chris, he's been using the lazy portfolio approach to investing, which we've talked about before on the show.
That's right. Yep.
And he uses something called the Simple Couch Potato Portfolio. I guess this is a brand of lazy portfolio?
That's correct.
Okay.
But there's some other ones.
Yes, and he says that he's heard of the Margaritaville portfolio, the second grader's starter portfolio, the no-brainer portfolio. You want to go through these and tell us what's the difference and which one he should be using?
Well, I think with the Margarita portfolio, you have to have Jimmy Buffett playing in the in the background.
And a parrot
absolutely
on your shoulder.
Wasting away again in Margaritaville.
Basically, he's right. They all use low-cost index funds. Mm-hmm. The major difference is how many funds do they include within the portfolio.
Uh-huh.
For example, the no-brainer portfolio, which is by William Bernstein. He's a neurologist who does a lot of stuff with investment. He's really good. So
hence
the William
Bernstein's no-brainer.
Exactly. The William Bernstein's basic no-brainer portfolio. It's very simple. It's just four funds, 25% in each fund. So you go with your Vanguard 500, the small cap, total international, total bond. But then he has the William Bernstein's no-brainer cowards portfolio.
Mm.
And that has 9 assets, so you're including some real estate investment trusts and some other things like that. And going through these different portfolios, they basically all have international stocks, domestic stocks, again, equity index,
trust.
The big two differences that I've noticed is whether they include a real estate investment trust index,
okay,
and whether or not they have Treasury inflation protected securities or not.
So do you have a recommendation on which of these you should look for and use?
No, I think they're all good.
All right. Well, there you go. You have your choice of portfolio, and Chris says that you're pretty safe with any of them. So if you've got some questions, do let us help. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's hit the phones. And Noli is with us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Noli.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm having trouble getting my financial manager off the ledge, but other than that, I'm fine.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear it. Well, maybe we can help you, and then you can help talk him down. How's that?
That's good.
Okay. Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I have a niece who is looking to buy a house with her new husband, and they're interested in getting the mortgage money from me rather than through a bank.
Okay.
And I was thinking of getting a mortgage manager or someone to be the bad guy, do all the dirty work of collecting all the money on the mortgage.
Chris, let me just say that the kind of the first thing that springs to mind for me is the Virgin Money website. This is Richard Branson, same guy who does Virgin Airlines. They set up this website where you can actually put together loans between yourself and friends and family and that sort of thing. Would that be something you'd recommend?
Absolutely. That's one of the websites you can go to. This is actually fairly easy to do, and I actually don't even think you need a middleman, and I'm going to explain why. But this is fairly common. It's fairly routine. I mean, it's not as routine as going to a financial institution, but loans among family members to buy a home, it's not uncommon, and it can be done very simply. The big key, well, there are several keys. First key is you charge a market rate of interest, and this way the IRS doesn't get upset at you.
And Chris, this is because if you don't charge interest, then the IRS is going to consider this a gift.
Right. So you just want to be, as long as it's market rate, then they say, well, it is a loan. The loan is being repaid. It's not a gift. And therefore, we don't have a problem with this. So that's one part of it. Second part of it is you should be represented by a real estate attorney. Your niece should be represented by a real estate attorney. And they'll basically draft up all the documents. You have a lot of flexibility if you just want to make it a straightforward loan and you get paid back with a rate, fixed rate of interest, that's fine. If you want to share in the profits when they sell it, you can do that. You just put that into the document. And what I would do is put into the document that in today's world, I mean, you just put automatic payment. You don't need a middleman. You just say you have to have automatic payment in your checking account that on the 15th day of the month or the first of the month, money automatically goes from their checking account into whatever account you designate.
Well, I don't like the idea of having a lien on my niece's house. And I was thinking of actually, once I develop a mortgage contract, donating it to a charity and have them be the recipients of the money.
If you want to give the charity out of a different pocket. But to set this up as, I think for both of you, it's actually better to set it up as a standard business relationship. I understand what you're saying, but set it up as a standard business relationship, which is also good for them. You're not going to seize the property. They're going to make their payments. You've made that judgment. So if they're going to make the payments and you can take that money and then you can donate it, the profits off the interest, the profits from the loan to a charity yourself, I think that would be much simpler, much cleaner. It also keeps it professional, which frankly, for their growth as they develop as a family, that's also a good thing.
All right. Does that help you out, Noli?
Very much. Thank you.
Terrific. Well, good luck and good luck to your niece as well with her new home.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
If you've got a question, do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And do stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You may have heard about the Etch-a-Sketch moment here in Los Angeles this week. Mother Nature attempted to clear the screen with 5.4 Richter's worth of shaking. I was actually a couple thousand miles away, but my colleagues at Marketplace say the windows rattled and a few things toppled over on shelves. Luckily, no one was hanging outside our building, or any other that we know of, doing what this next gentleman does every day in his work life.
I'm David Viner. I am a residential window cleaner, and I've been doing this since 1983.
Well, I'm filling up right now my bucket, and then we're off to wash some windows. I soap up the window, and then I take my window squeegee, and I go right along the edge, and then I take a clean terry cotton towel, and I buff the glass to a beautiful shine that lasts for months and months.
I serve clients. Some of them are prominent politicians, lawyers. And I'm asked to come in by a service entrance. I'm asked to leave by the service entrance. I'm maybe looked down upon, but I'm comfortable with what I do. It is not an easy task. It is not an easy job. I start early in the morning. I must average between 12 to 16 hours a day. And when I put my head down to sleep, I am almost like passed out. But what a sleep, though. The hardest windows are solariums. They're usually a glass room. Some of them are quite high. And you have to walk, get this, on glass, but not really. You walk on the window frames, and if you're not precise, you could go through. Back in 1990, it was winter time, and I was asked to do a commercial building, and I needed to use my ladder, and I could not find any help, and my ladder gave way, and I fell, and I sprained my ankle. Well, for 4 months, I couldn't work. I'm in a seasonal kind of work. If I have a good run of weather, I can make close to $100,000 and more. And if weather is an issue, I barely make $50,000. The most beautiful part of my work is after I'm done, on a sunny day, and the sun shines in, and it lights up the room naturally. Even as a kid, Saturdays, it was cleaning day, and I always got the windows. That's where I really enjoyed cleaning windows. I would step back and see what I did, and I'd go, what a job I did. And I was Mama's little helper.
That was David Viner, a professional window washer. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. Still waiting in line for an iPhone 3G? Time to read between those lines and ask yourself, why do we buy what we buy?
Much of the point of branding is just to get the idea of a product into your head and kind of to give you a shortcut so that you avoid a lot of reflection and you're kind of acting almost in an instinctual manner.
Brand brainwashing is next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is the brand Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Lots of us are scaling back on spending these days. You know, one thing that's often the first to go are brand name products. Maybe you dump Tony the Tiger for a generic box of Frosted Flakes, or the back-to-school sneakers for the kids do not have a Nike swoosh. Yes, you're saving money, but if you're really into labels, or your kids are, it's a little disheartening. But why? Why are we so invested in name brands? Well, Rob Walker has an idea. He's the author of Buying In, the Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We've been hearing for years now, and you address this fairly early on in the book, that the consumer is now in charge. And a lot of that is because of the internet. You know, we can all go on and we can find the best deals and we can find out all this information about the products. You say this really isn't true. Why is that and how is that?
Well, I talk about the dialogue, but I also call it a secret dialogue. And the reason that I say that, there's two reasons for that. One is that, you know, while a lot of attention is given to the new forms of control that consumers have, the new sort of tools we have at our disposal, what gets kind of ignored is all the new tools that advertisers have at their disposal, which in some cases are the same kinds of tools. The internet has hardly proven to be an ad-free zone. And the other side of the secret part is that, you know, we kind of sometimes, I think, overestimate when we have this idea that, like, well, I'm brand proof, I'm not affected by advertising and marketing messages. It kind of puts us in this mental place where we're ignoring a lot of the kind of non-conscious processes that guide what we end up buying. And that's the secret part.
Isn't a lot of marketing these days kind of targeted to the people who say that they don't buy into marketing?
Well, one of the weirdest stories that came up that's part of the book, actually, was the sort of adoption of Pabst Blue Ribbon along these lines as this kind of anti-brand brand of beer. You know, there were consumers who were talking about it as, well, I'm sick of all the beer advertising. There's no advertising for this stuff. It's kind of an anti-statement. And the really weird thing about that is that that's an idea that came from consumers. The people at PBR did not dream that up. And when it first started happening, they had no idea what was going on.
You know, I also love the example of the Livestrong wristbands. As you say, they had no practical function. They were this awful bright yellow, so hardly a fashion statement. And the question you raised, which I thought was very interesting, was why not just donate to the foundation? If that was your point in buying it, you know, why not have your full dollar go toward that cause instead of, you know, the 70 cents out of the dollar? What's your answer to that?
And I don't mean to pick on anyone who's wearing one. I have no problem with it. But, you know, I think it's another thing where the meaning of that object came from us, came from consumers who came up with a number of different things. And sometimes it was supporting a good cause, and sometimes it had to do with maybe an individual in their life who they were supporting. You know, not only this point about why not give them the whole dollar, at the height of that craze, the supply and demand were so out of whack that people were actually selling them on eBay. So you could buy one on eBay in the secondary market for like 10 bucks, and none of that money went to charity. So it shows how hard people will try to participate in something like that.
Throughout the book, you talk about cracking what you call the desire code. And certainly from a marketer's perspective, that's very easy to understand. You've got to figure out how to make your product desirable for the consumer. That's what it's all about, generating profits. Mm-hmm. On the reverse, for those of us who are the consumer, how do we change our behaviors? How do we crack that desire code from our end?
Much of the point of branding is just to get the idea of a product into your head and kind of to give you a shortcut so that you avoid a lot of reflection and you're kind of acting almost in an instinctual manner. And the way to come at it, I think, is to really give some reflection to, like, well, what are the purchase decisions that are important to me? Then also, what are the things that I can satisfy in some other way? You know, the craving for individuality or to be part of something, maybe what you buy isn't the best way to satisfy those particular desires.
Rob Walker is the author of Buying In, and you can also find him in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He is the columnist for Consumed. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Here's one way to convince yourself that you don't need those name brand shoes or pants or beer. Remember that you can't take it with you. Of course, that applies to generic stuff as well. But the point is, when you're 6 feet under, it's just you and the worms. Last week, we concluded our series about financial planning for the big dirt nap. Estate planning is the technical term for it, or would that be estate? Anyway, we asked John Ventura, the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning, why people are so reluctant to think about the inevitable end of their lives.
There's a couple of things that are happening. One is, I think, a psychological thing. People feel like they're too young to even deal with these kind of issues.
But as we pointed out several times, it's not about age. It's about everybody you leave behind, whenever that might be.
You know, nowadays, a lot of people are starting their careers right out of college. They're going to start to build wealth. They're going to, within a matter of a few years, probably buy a property, buy a home, a condo. And you still want to have the right to make the decision who's going to get these things. So the earlier you can start dealing with that, the better.
So, in case you missed our 6-week odyssey into estate planning, we've put it all together in a special podcast. Head to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Estate Planning in the Web Surfer box. Time once again for Marketplace Money's Summer School. This week, the difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction. At the blackboard to explain is certified public accountant Nancy Chandler.
A tax credit is an actual credit against your tax. Once your tax has been computed, it will reduce the tax, such as the child care credit or a credit for purchasing a hybrid vehicle. A tax deduction reduces your taxable income before the tax is computed. Tax deductions are medical expenses, charitable contributions, real estate taxes, and mortgage interest. A tax credit is much better than a tax deduction because it's dollar for dollar against the tax. A tax deduction just reduces taxable income, and taxable income may be taxed at 15% or 28%. Tax deductions can be limited as far as the amount you can write off. So if you purchase a computer for your business, you first have to go above 2% of your adjusted gross income, and once you get there, then you can write the rest off. Everyone is entitled to a standard deduction, and if you're a low income or you have very few itemized deductions, you may be better off taking the standard deduction rather than itemizing your deductions.
Nancy Chandler is with the firm Kellogg and Andelson here in Los Angeles. Next week, we go into universal default.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We're back with Getting Personal. And, Chris, let's get right to an email. Kenneth writes in from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he's retired, has a number of separate retirement accounts. He says he's got, get this, a 403B, a 457B, a 401A, and a 403 supplemental with Fidelity. All of these accounts, the result of him working for a single employer. Now that he's retired, Fidelity has called him a bunch of times asking why he hasn't rolled his accounts over into an IRA. So his question is there a reason why he should do this? And on top of all that, is there a reason Fidelity would want to make sure he did that?
Well, they would like the money to stay within the Fidelity family, just in case the employer maybe decided to change what was the mutual fund company or financial institution they're working with. All right, so whatever the reason, I think it's not a bad idea to do a rollover IRA. And here's why. You no longer work for an employer. You care about that money. And if you have, what accounts did he have? What did you have, 403B, you said?
457B, 401A, 403B, 403 supplemental.
Let's make life a little bit easier. So you do a rollover IRA, and instead of having multiple accounts, we have multiple mutual fund options, you know, some conservative options, perhaps some longer-term equity options. Whatever he's going to do is diversification and asset allocation. But he does the rollover IRA, then it's easy for him to monitor it. It's easy for him to watch it, and then he can make choices, how much he has in cash, how much in stocks, how much in bonds.
And is there a possibility that if he were to do a rollover IRA that his choices might expand? Because don't employers sometimes limit what your investment options are?
Absolutely, to keep the cost down and also to, you know, stop employee confusion. But when you do a rollover IRA into a company like Vanguard or Fidelity or whomever, I mean, that whole universe of mutual funds opens up to you.
Yeah. Into his question about why Fidelity would be urging him to do this, do they make money off of it if he rolls over?
Well, they don't make money off it directly. Typically for a rollover, there might be a very, very modest transaction fee. I'd be surprised that there's any fee associated with it. And in most cases I looked at, there isn't a fee. I'm just sort of hesitating for a moment because I actually am not sure with Fidelity. But the reason is they want your assets. Why would they charge you a fee? They want the assets under management, and then what they do is they charge you an ongoing fee, right, for managing your money. And that may be, depending on the fund, it could be half a percentage point, it could be 1.5 percentage points. So, yes, it's in their self-interest to do it. But I also think, for Kenneth, makes a lot of sense.
All right. Well, if you've got a rollover question, you know, even if your question is what the heck is a rollover, we can help. Visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's go to the phones again. And Doug is on the line from right here in the City of Angels. Hi, Doug.
Hey.
So what's your question for Chris today?
All right. Just a little background.
Okay.
In the early 1990s, my wife and I came in some money, and we decided to put the money in an index fund. Well, many years passed. A few months before Y2K, we got nervous, thought that the stock market might spiral out of control. So we took it out for a year, put it in a one-year bond. We earned 4%, of course, while the stock market went up 20%. So we put the money back in the index fund, and sure enough, the fund has barely budged upward.
So you would be the poster child for... not trying to time the market, right?
Exactly. Okay. In fact, I'm trying to have a positive perspective, but when it comes to investing, I don't think of myself as a failure, but rather as an expert at discovering what doesn't work.
Okay.
My friend suggested that my wife and I put our money in a managed fund run by a discount brokerage firm. So my question is a fee-based managed account a better choice than a low-fund index fund?
Ah, I have a better option for you. And it's lower cost, and you end up with a well-diversified portfolio. And I'd make a pretty big bet, at least a dollar.
Oh, boy, you are all for the risk, man.
I am, man. That you'll outperform, you know, the sort of fee-based money management. And it is, they come by different names depending on the company. But there's a target fund, target date fund, lifestyle fund. But essentially, these are well-diversified portfolios, and you make a decision about how much risk you want to take and around the time that you might be considering retiring or you might want to be starting to draw on the money, so you want to be in a more conservative posture, and you sit back. It's what we call a default option, but I think it's a really good default option. Doug, they had your name written on it when they were setting these things up.
But then aren't these also a managed type account?
They're managed, but typically they're managed on autopilot. They're made up of index funds. They're made up of very low-cost funds. So there's very little management fee that is associated with these funds. Now, for most people, is a really good option, and they get what I think is important, low fees, diversification, and they have a pretty good sense of why this fund will evolve the way it is. As I get older, it gets a little more conservative, as I'm leaning toward retirement, but it doesn't make any dramatic moves, and it's not a market timing fund.
Well, I thank you very much. Expect a call in 5 years, and I'll let you know how I did.
That would be great.
I'm putting the dollar aside right now.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Doug.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. A warning to investors this week. Think twice before borrowing from your retirement accounts, especially if you're doing it with one of those new 401k debit cards. The warning is courtesy of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Labor Department, who want you to have enough money to retire. And earlier this month, New York Senator Charles Schumer introduced a bill that actually bans 401k debit cards. We asked Jeremy Hobson to look into the costs of making it so easy to borrow from your future.
If you Google 401k debit cards, the first thing that pops up is a website titled "The 401k Debit Card, Probably One of the Worst Ideas Ever." And that's just what Christian Weller at the Center for American Progress thinks of it.
The fear is that with a 401k debit card, more and more people will access their 401ks, not just for emergencies, but for, I don't know, frivolous spending, if you will, like a latte or an iPod or a plasma screen TV.
Now, taking money out of a retirement account early isn't new. People often do it to pay for medical expenses or homes. But withdrawals require a lot of paperwork, and in many cases, you have to pay back your withdrawal with interest. Plus, you can be hit with income taxes and a 10% penalty. Some in Congress worry a debit card makes retirement borrowing easier, so they want to outlaw the cards before they become too popular. Bruce Bent heads the Reserve Fund, the largest provider of 401k debit cards with customers numbering in the thousands. He recently told Congress that allowing easier access to retirement savings actually encourages people to invest.
What we're finding statistically is more people are willing to participate because they feel the access and the money is available to them.
In an email response to Marketplace's questions, Bent's company said it charges up to 3% interest on withdrawals. That's on top of government penalties. And Christian Weller says that's the problem.
Given that most people borrow from their 401k because they've gotten into economic troubles, I think layering that trouble on with more fees and costs is the wrong move.
Administrators of 401k plans are skeptical of debit cards, too. Bob Wolfing is with the industry's main trade group, the Spark Institute.
I don't know if it's the dumbest idea in the world, but the loan process should be, you know, a very, you know, thoughtful process where you're looking at all your alternatives and your last alternative is your 401k plan.
Still, Wolfing says Congress shouldn't regulate the debit cards. He says people simply need to be educated about the consequences of dipping into retirement savings early. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the financial upside of going veggie.
You know, I could take an avocado, sprinkle a little bit of kelp on it, and have a little bit of seaweed, like dull seaweed, and I'm good to go.
Wouldn't that be a downside? Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, Jeff Peters, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media.